As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. The chairman will speak today. It will be a sober conversation, a sober set of Q&A. And part of it will be reading William Dudley's essay for Bloomberg Opinion this morning, where Bill Dudley, the former president of the New York Fed, of course, for decades at Goldman Sachs, simply says, learn how to spell it. It is a hard landing. Bill Dudley, how do you know or discern a recession coming? The distinction of a 1994 soft landing, looking at a Goldilocks recession, if you will, of Greenspan, or a more difficult recession. How do you get out front of that intellectually?
I don't think it has to be a really deep recession. I mean, deep recessions typically occur when something breaks, like the global financial crisis is a good example of that. I think what the Federal Reserve has to do is generate enough slack in the economy to bring down inflation. That means the unemployment rate has to go up. The problem that the Fed has is it's very hard to push the unemployment rate up only a little bit. Every time the unemployment rate's gone up by more than 0.5%, you've had a full-blown recession. There's no reason to think that it's going to be any different this time.
Will the chairman today say what you say in your essay, that suddenly employment as a mandate is subservient? Is that where we're heading?
Well, that's what the Fed already sort of told us in their FOMC statement. They took out the reference to the labor market remaining so strong. They're very much focused now on inflation as opposed to employment, because the labor market is too tight as opposed to not tight enough. So I think he'll reiterate the message that we heard in his press conference last week. I think also, though, he will not talk about a hard landing. The Fed is still going for a soft landing, and of course they should. The problem is it's just going to be very difficult for them to pull this off.
Bill, a lot of people in the market right now are trying to draw a distinction between a soft recession or a shallow one and one that is much more damaging. What is the characteristic of the hard landing you envision?
Well, I think it's going to be a relatively mild recession at this point, because the financial system looks like it's pretty solid. Household and business balance sheets look like they're pretty solid. You really get a deep downturn when things in the financial system break and the ability to supply credit to people becomes impaired. I don't expect that to happen this time. So I would expect a mild recession like 1990 or 2001, not a deep recession like 73, 74. Or, of course, the great financial crisis.
A lot of people would push back, Bill, and say that this Fed has no appetite for causing a recession. They don't seem to want to do that, and that they will eventually pivot away from raising rates as much as people currently expect. Why do you think that's not the case? Why do you think they're going to take a page from Paul Volcker?
Well, I don't think they want a recession. The problem is that if you're going to get inflation down, you need more slack in the economy. And it's very hard to generate more slack in the economy without actually generating recession. So that they're definitely going for a soft landing. It's just going to be almost impossible for them to pull it off.
But is the assumption you're making, Bill, that they're not going to blink even when the data turns more dramatically than we already have seen it having? I mean, Larry Summers was talking about a 5% unemployment rate over the next 5 years. Where do you think their tolerance is?
Well, I think what Larry's talking about is certainly reasonable. I think the reason why they're not going to blink at the end of the day is they know that if they blink and don't get inflation down, then they have to do even more later. Postponing, procrastination is not a great option. We saw what happened in the 1960s and 70s when the Federal Reserve was slow to tackle inflation. What happened was inflation got out of hand and Paul Volcker had to come in and put the U.S. economy through the ringer. So the Fed wants to do what's necessary in the near term so they don't have to do a lot more in the longer term.
But it is in the longer term that you really see the full effects of monetary policy taking shape. It operates with a lag. We all understand that. So I guess the question is, if they're front-loading and aggressive, are they going to see it reflected in the actual data we're getting, or do they risk just moving way too aggressively and then the data turns all at once?
Well, that's what could actually happen, because right now the economy has considerable forward momentum as the economy reopens and payroll gains are very strong. Household balance sheets are still very solid, boosted by the fiscal stimulus that we got over the last couple of years. But beneath that, things are trouble. Inflation is rising faster than wages. Financial conditions have tightened a great deal. So what I think is going to happen is the economy is going to be fine over the next few months. And then we're going to see a very sharp slowdown, probably in the first half of 2023.
Bill, I just want to build on something that Kaylee was talking about with that 5% unemployment figure from Larry Summers over the next 5 years, and that's what he thinks is necessary to bring inflation down. What happens if you start to see the unemployment numbers climb, but the inflation figures do not come down because of those lag effects, like rents, for example, that are continuing to climb? How does the Fed handle that based on your conversations and your experience on the central bank?
Well, I think you're right that inflation is probably not going to come down that quickly because there are lags in price rate in companies raising prices. Also, I think the Ukraine-Russia war complicates things enormously because it looks like the energy price shock and the food shock is going to last longer because of the war. So I think that the Fed has gotten very unlucky in terms of the kind of inflation shocks that we're seeing. They're likely to be persistent, and that's going to make it difficult for the Fed to reverse course.
Bill Dudley, John Taylor's at a school. You may know it across the bay from Berkeley. It's Stanford, I think is what it's called. And I can just see John Taylor with a full balloon in his freshman economics class, letting the air out of it ever so slowly. We have a fiscal balloon, some 30% of GDP. How long will it take to let the air out of that fiscal balloon? Is a central bank, is that a three-year project, or do you really see it out almost to a decade?
I don't think it should take as long as a decade, but fiscal policy is a factor behind why we're probably going to see a sharp slowdown at some point, because fiscal policy, while it has been very stimulative over the last 2 years, that stimulus is over. We've also seen households begin to pull down their savings rate. So the savings rate was very elevated as the fiscal policy stimulus was being put in place. But the savings rate now has already fallen below its long run average, which tells you that consumers are a little bit stressed, are starting to experience a little bit of stress in terms of their balance sheets.
Bill Dudley, required reading, folks, before the testimony of Chairman Powell, the Humphrey Hawkins testimony, a monetary report by the Chairman of the Federal Reserve. And we'll get Bill Dudley out on social here as quick as we can. You can see that, of course, at Bloomberg.com. He speaks of a hard landing is well. Bill, I look at this and I think if Jerome Powell was to read your essay, you wonder how he would amend his discussion today. I mean, he's not going to say hard landing, but how does he address the probabilities, the set of outcomes that we may see?
Well, he's made it more clear that it's going to be more difficult. The longer inflation stays as high as it's been, the harder the Fed's job is. And he's admitted that in his press conference. So I think today he's going to make it clear that this is not going to be easy. He's going to talk about that there is a path to a soft landing. I think that path is extraordinarily narrow. He won't talk about how narrow that path is. He'll just talk about that's what the Federal Reserve is trying to seek and pull off this time.
Bill, what kind of financial breaking do you foresee being a trigger for the Fed? And I say this as the yen weakens to the weakest levels we've seen versus the dollar since 1998. And people are starting to get concerned about deteriorating liquidity in certain bond markets.
Well, I think the biggest area of stress, frankly, is going to be low and moderate income countries who are hurt by, one, a stronger dollar, higher grain prices, and higher energy prices. For poorer countries, grain and energy is a pretty significant portion of the household consumption basket. So they're going to be hit very severely over the next 12 to 18 months. So I expect a lot of sovereign debt problems in the next year or two. And that's going to just be more problematic for the global economy.
So, Bill, at what point does a strong dollar create a real issue? And this is something that I was thinking about, especially as a growing number of investors see the dollar as the main hedge against equity weakness. At what point is it a trigger for the Fed?
Well, the Fed actually is not unhappy with the dollar being stronger because a stronger dollar holds down U.S. inflation by making import prices cheaper. And it also slows down the economy by reducing U.S. export competitiveness. So when you think about it, the Fed wants tighter financial conditions, higher bond yields, weaker stock prices, stronger dollar. The dollar is actually the most attractive of those three things because a stronger dollar actually increases your purchasing power. So the dollar strength is not something that the Federal Reserve views as a bug. They view this as a feature.
Well, speaking of the financial markets, we heard from Tom Barkin yesterday. We will again today, but he essentially said that you want to get back to where you want to go as fast as you can without breaking anything, talking about not wanting to cause undue harm, not just to the economy, but to financial markets. What harm would that be? What would make the Fed put kick back in, Bill?
I think you'd have to see some sort of calamity in financial markets that impeded market function, impeded the ability of banks to lend money to households and businesses. I don't expect that. I think the reforms that we made following the great financial crisis in terms of the banking system, more capital, more liquidity, better risk management, better governance, those have shown to work, and I think they'll work this time as well.
Bill, I just want to say in your wonderful essay, I don't know which is more important, that you quoted the great economist Claudia Sahm or you quoted the other economist Wile E. Coyote. I'll let you decide which one. I think that's great to see here. Bill Dudley, thank you so much, the former president of the New York Fed.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Right now, Professor Ebi Joseph Cohen joins us. She is entrenched at the Columbia Business School and, of course, for decades at Goldman Sachs is a partner. Professor, how's it going? What a shift to go from the 25-hour week of Goldman Sachs down to the cushy job as a professor at one of our acclaimed schools. How abrupt has the shift been?
Well, it was 25 hours a day, not a week.
Excuse me. Correct.
That's quite all right. It has been a wonderful adjustment right. For me, frankly. You know, I was an adjunct at Columbia for almost a decade, so I knew what I was getting into. I love the students at Columbia. Half of them are from overseas, and it's a terrific right. faculty. I'm spending time with a lot of the faculty working on new curriculum. Materials right. for them, incorporating the real world aspects into the academic work.
And the foundation here, folks, is something that's a rite of passage if you're in the racket. you must read either 1934 Graham Dodd, or maybe you catch up with Graham Dodd and Cottle. Right now, we look at Graham Dodd and Joseph Cohen, which is going to be the new definitive book out of Columbia Business School. How do you take the fundamentals that we were weaned on and drag them forward into Jerome Powell's modern age?
Tom, that is a wonderful question, but first let me set the stage. And that is to say, for the last few years, the fundamentals have mattered less than things like momentum and investor enthusiasm. Now, you take a look, for example, at the strong correlation between the technology stocks, cryptocurrency, and so on, and basically say these are types of financial assets in which valuation approaches really didn't matter very much. And I think we're now back into a period in which it does matter, where it's the fundamentals of earnings, the fundamentals of margins, the fundamentals of inflation and interest rates, and putting that all together in terms of appropriate valuation models, that will make a big difference for investors going forward.
Abby, how do you model the fundamentals at a time when people can't game out whether we're going to have a sanguine economy or a hard landing that looks something like a depression? At what point do you game out recessionary outcomes in your fundamental analysis?
Yeah, you know, there are two different ways to look at that, Lisa. First of all, we can game out alternative scenarios. So we have some sense of what the range of possibilities might be, not just for equities, but other financial assets. But of course, at the end of the day, an investor or portfolio manager has to say, what do I think is the most likely scenario? You can always plan for the worst if you have very little risk tolerance. You can always plan for the best if you're highly risk averse. But I think many portfolio managers are aiming for something in the middle where they're trying to identify what is the most likely scenario.
Right.
And as some of your earlier guests indicated, what seems to be priced in right now is a mild recession, certainly not a severe recession.
When you look at the parameters, do you look at the end of the era of free money, or do you look at just simply a pause, a momentary reprieve from the ultra low rates of more than a decade as we try to curtail inflation and then a reversion back to that at the end?
Yeah, let me adjust the question just a little bit, Lisa, and to say that money isn't free anymore, but in many cases, it's not particularly expensive, particularly by historical standards. And so while we have seen this rise in interest rates and the Fed is likely to continue to move those short rates higher, we've already seen quite an increase in the intermediates and the longs and the rates that affect consumers, for example, through mortgages. And so what we have to recognize is that when money becomes more expensive, in some ways, investors, households become much more careful with it. Because if it's no longer free, you're going to see less leverage, which is a good thing in portfolios. For example, we've had incredible returns in some private equity portfolios. Maybe the basic returns were good, but in some cases they've been turbocharged by significant amounts of leverage, which sort of hide the underlying skill set, if you will, of the portfolio manager. And then, of course, there are many corporations that took advantage of very inexpensive money to leverage up their results. And so when money is no longer free, we get to see a better picture of whether those corporate managers and those portfolio managers are actually doing a good job.
Well, Abby, you talk about how people are more careful with their money in this kind of environment. And we know that it wasn't just, you know, corporations and big port institutional investors that were moving money around during the pandemic free money era. You also had stimulus that was fueling the retail investor, and they have been a force within these markets. What happens when that goes away?
What we are looking at, of course, is a situation in which individuals in many cases became overly enthusiastic about some areas of the market, equities and elsewhere, including digital currencies that offered good momentum. And what we are moving into and have already begun to see is what happens when the momentum breaks down and you need to start looking at the valuations per se. Now, individual investors, of course, have many different factors that they need to be concerned about. Some of it has to do with how much longer they have in their investment horizon, what else they might need the capital for, and so on.
Right.
And so we may in fact see less money, and we have already seen this, going into things like cap-weighted ETFs. We've not yet seen the intermediate aspect, and I don't think it's going to be all that bad, frankly. Just looking at the demographic.
I say this in great honor of your 2005 paper, which is definitive, folks. It's basically codified within the CFA Institute. Aristotle on investment decision making. We have dragged ourselves, Professor, from the elegance of 2005 to a 2022 discussion of what's called a cathartic puke. How does catharsis play into fundamental analysis and the confidence to own equities? Do I need to go down substantially to find a base to own equities?
We are now, I believe, Tom, in a situation where beta will be less important than alpha. And that
explain that, please. That's really important. Explain that.
Investors always think that they are smart in a bull market, right? So if you're invested in a bull market, almost anywhere in a bull market, the beta of the market, and that has to do just with slopes of lines and so on. Don't confuse basically a bull market for genius. And so that's beta. Alpha is security selection. And one of the curious things about the last 2 to 3 years in particular is that it's been really hard to get alpha. So investors, professionals who've used sophisticated approaches, trying to identify what particular securities they wanted to invest in, often stumbled because alpha didn't matter very much. With this dramatic reset in the markets, the overall decline, number one, number two, the breakdown of the momentum orientation, and number three, the recognition that the economic cycle itself is shifting, we see a move now, I believe, toward alpha. And that's not just within the U.S. equity market. It's likely to happen in other developed markets as well.
Yeah.
And also, think of it more broadly in terms of asset categories that are no longer all going to be moving in lockstep.
Well, that's exactly where I wanted to go, Abby, and we just have about a minute left. Does this mean that it's the end of the sort of standard 60-40 in terms of just working and needing a more nuanced, scalpeled approach, even with asset allocation?
Let's recognize that 30-year plus period in which inflation and interest rates were under good control and continue to move lower is over. That doesn't mean that a year or two from now, inflation will be under incredible uncontrol and interest rates still dramatically rising. I don't expect that. But we are exiting that 30-year period in which fixed income securities were a very good place to be invested. And that 40% rule right now may not be such a clever thing. One other point, if I may, that Aristotle paper talks about the importance of understanding the data. Let me give you one example right now. There's so much focus on headline CPI. You guys have done a great job of contrasting headline CPI to core CPI. What the Fed is looking at is the better measure, which is core PCE, which is running 3 to 4 percentage points below the headline CPI. So rather than looking at like an 8% number, they're looking at a number which is 5%, and maybe even a little bit lower. It's still a rise in inflation. I don't mean to suggest not, but it is not quite as awful looking as the headlines would suggest.
Abby Joseph Cohen, thank you so much for joining Bloomberg and Bloomberg Surveillance today at Columbia Business School. Lisa Shallet, from the mating of Alliance Capital and Sanford Bernstein years ago over to her duties as Chief Investment Officer at Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. Been there, done that. She has seen the dreaded conversation of recession. Lisa, how foolish is it for Morgan Stanley clients to angst over the guesstimates of what recession will be?
Look, we've always said that, you know, it's foolish for our clients to try to guess. I mean, one of the things that we were talking about with clients yesterday is Some of the folks who get paid to do this, i.e. at the Fed, have never gotten recession forecasts correct, ever. I think this is something that David Rosenberg also wrote about yesterday in his wonderful piece that he puts out daily. And the fact of the matter is, you know, the best we can do is try to ascertain direction and relative order of magnitude. And other than that, I don't think we can try to, you know, hand wring about, you know, where the bottom is and, you know, how far will it go and what, you know, is going to be affected until we're really, you know, kind of in it.
Well, hand-wringing aside, when you look at the tea leaves and this idea that certain tech companies in particular are starting to lay off members of their staff or cut back on hiring plans, Lisa, have we entered a new phase of the economic cycle that is beginning on the edges and requires a shift in strategy?
I think that we're actually, you know, as you know, markets always, you know, are 6 to 9 months ahead of reality. I am in the camp that the price action we have seen thus far, this bear market, has probably discounted at least, you know, 2/3 to 7/8 of the way there to what we're guessing, and I use the word guessing, is going to be a shallow recession. In that spirit, I think what's different about the labor market this time is that, you know, we have never had the number of job openings and the ratio of job openings to applicants that, you know, we came into this period having. And so while we are starting to see some modest uptick in layoffs from, you know, some handful of companies, I think that what's going to be different this time is that labor and the unemployment rate is actually going to hold up much better because we have this cushion that what companies will do first is eliminate their job openings as opposed to going immediately to firings and staff reductions.
Well, on the subject of labor, higher labor costs obviously are one of the higher cost companies are facing, raising the question of margin pressure as there's continued kind of inflationary dynamics in this economy. What are your thoughts on the trajectory of margins from here, Lisa, and if expectations of them are still too high?
Absolutely. Look, I mean, back in the fourth quarter of last year, one of the things, you know, that we were, you know, trying to be very loud about was the unsustainability of margins. We felt that, you know, when we were seeing these peak operating margins for the S&P 500 well into the double digits, profits as a share of GDP where they were, that we were witnessing, you know, record operating leverage that was a result of this mismatch between, the pricing power that companies had at the beginning of the reopening of the economy and their actual costs. And there are lags because of the way we account for inventory and the way we hire and the way, you know, we expense CapEx and things of that nature. Now we're in the catch-up phase. And our view is that margins are really going to be vulnerable. And this has been one of the, you know, great mysteries, I think, is why the sell side has been so complacent to earnings estimates.
Lisa, this is critical. This is right where I wanted to go, running out of time. If the sell side has been complacent, are we going to be surprised by corporate use of cash that shrinks?
Potentially. And I think that, you know, this has been the problem is that the sell side analysts have stopped actually doing work since the era of, you know, Reg FD. And, you know, they just listen to what executives say and executives don't want to say anything until the exact minute.
Lisa.
That their lawyers let them say.
It's our third rail, Lisa. I've been screaming here. You don't see this, folks, off camera, but I've been screaming about Reg FD and the effect here on surprise. I mean, Lisa, it's tangible. They can't talk until they're right there.
They can't talk until they're right there, and the analysts have stopped doing work, and they just listen to the words coming out of the mouths of either corporate management or our Federal Reserve chairman. It is really awful, and, you know, investors are smarter than that. And our guess is that, you know, there is a large amount of the earnings disappointment that has been priced in. We just need to see those estimate cuts kick in so that we can ascertain what is the real price earnings ratio of this market. I mean, right now, I think it's a bit artificial.
Bottle it. Lisa Shalit there with a quote of the week. Lisa Shalit, Morgan Stanley, thank you so much.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
An extraordinary time, Tim, to cut to the chase. In the IEA report, what is the distinction that the prime minister and the leader of labor need to know? What do they need to know right now from IEA?
I think one thing they need to know is that we simply haven't been putting enough capital into the energy sector in recent years. And that's true whether you look at it from the perspective of energy transitions. So we haven't been investing enough in clean. And then partially because we haven't done that, that means that the amount of money going into the traditional sector, so oil and gas, has also been not enough to avoid the sort of volatility that we're seeing today.
Tim, I've got a really basic question. Has Russian oil actually been taken off the market or just re-diverted through China, through India and the refineries there, and then sold back to the West?
So there is clearly some impacts on Russia already of the measures that are in place. But if you look at the data for exports, there hasn't been a huge amount of change since the invasion in February. And so there is that evidence of a reorientation rather than a reduction when it comes to Russian flows into international markets.
So who's pocketing the difference? I mean, if you're dealing with the gas and the crude that's being sold at a discount from Russia, and then it's being sold at anything but a discount everywhere else within the developed world, who's getting that delta?
I mean, it's an unusually profitable moment to be in the refining business right now. I mean, their refining margins are very high, and refining margins are particularly high if your input crude is heavily discounted Russian crude.
Well, but quickly here, Tim, there is this allegation that some people have that actually India and refineries there are benefiting on all sides, and a lot of the gasoline and the refined goods the United States and other nations in the developed world are importing are actually Russian crude that just have been funneled into a form that they can use. Is that accurate?
I think it's very difficult to tell the provenance of the molecules that come out of a refinery. There's no way to distinguish the outputs of a refinery based on the normally based on the origins of the crude. So I think that's a very difficult question to answer directly.
Okay, Tim, well, you're an economist, and as the Biden administration pushes Congress to enact a pause on the gasoline tax here in America to provide some relief at the pump, will that actually work as intended, even if it got through Congress?
I mean, we're very focused on the underlying dynamics, and the fact is that oil and gas upstream investment has come down by half since 2014. And that's added to some of the pressures that we see on markets today. So what we're focused on is which way do we get out of today's crisis? And essentially, there's two baskets of options. One is around doubling down on fossil fuels, and the other one is investing in new areas of the energy economy. And certainly from an IEA perspective, we're very keen that the upswing that we've seen in clean energy investment in 2022, we're keen to see that gain further momentum, because we think that's the only lasting way out of the crisis that we're having today.
Well, and Tim, of course, by nature, it is a transition. We don't just arrive at a moment in which we are entirely reliant on clean energy. You still need fossil fuels there as a backstop, because many of these clean energy sources are intermittent by nature. The sun doesn't always shine. The wind isn't always blowing. How do both of these things play together, where we can't wean ourselves off of fossil fuels? You can't get to green energy at the same time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that we try and avoid saying, is that there's a very sort of binary, clean, dirty element. You just need to scale up one and reduce the other. There is this sort of coexistence of energy systems for many, many years to come. And you need to make sure that all parts of that system are functioning in a way that allows us to have affordable, secure energy. So I very much agree. You know, we need to focus also on all of the energy services, the reliability that you can still get from traditional forms of supply.
Tim Gould, the thickness of the IEA effort here, I think of Adam Siminski's work over the years, and then I look at Christian Malek and J.P. Morgan, where in 100 pages, they say the foundation of all of this is population growth in emerging markets. You own this at IEA. You've had the courage to go beyond the developed countries and look at emerging markets as well. Is the case for higher oil prices simply a burgeoning population in emerging markets?
I think it's more than that. It's about the economic growth. It's the rising incomes. It's the aspirations that many people in emerging markets and developing economies have for the lifestyles that we have in many advanced economies. And that is going to drive developments in the energy sector for many years to come. But the question is, what sort of model are these countries going to be pursuing? Is it the same one? Is it the same path that we've trodden all these years? Or is there a new lower emissions path that is now available because of some of the increasingly accessible and affordable clean technologies that are on the market?
Tim, thank you so much for this report from the International Energy Association. Tim Gould with us there this morning. Paul, I got to get to this real quickly here because it's too important. Last night I was watching Dodgers Reds.
Really?
Gonsolin is just unbelievable. 8-0, and there's people comparing him to Koufax. And I'm like, Koufax? I'm getting hot under the collar. Wow. I'm getting upset. Even though Koufax went to the University of Cincinnati as a walk-on basketball player, we got to get straight on this right now. Joining us, Douglas Cass on the markets. We'll get to it. But I'm sorry, this guy having a career year with the Dodgers, Doug Cass, he's no Sandy Koufax, is he?
1 year does not a career make.
There we go.
Story of my career.
Oh, by the way, did you see the statue?
Yes. What'd you think?
Sandy Koufax statue placed last week.
Yeah. Okay. Doug, I got to get to this because I just think it's too important. Baseball's gotten boring. And one of the things that Koufax did that Gonsolin's also doing is limiting their walks per game. That's like the heart of the matter. It's just, I mean, that's what made Sandy Koufax in 1963. He just cut down on the walks. That's all there is to it. I'm just trying to avoid the market.
The rules.
I'm doing everything I can.
And by the way, baseball is not boring. It's boring to you. It's not boring to the 50 and 18 New York Yankees.
That's true.
That's right. Thank you.
They're killing it. Okay, Doug, the market, let's get right to it. Is just Paul alluded to earlier, can you buy stocks? Can you own stocks? Can you be long given the gloom?
Yeah. There is an English expression that encapsulates the markets that's claimed to be a translation of traditional Chinese curse. That expression is, may you live in interesting times, and we certainly live in interesting times. I think that the one has to be struck by the change in the market zeitgeist today versus 6 months ago, when I was negative, and now I'm substantially less cautious, and I have been slowly accumulating in that long position. 6 months ago, if you remember, there was a preponderance of negative optionality of expected outcomes. Speculation was acute. Valuations were priced to perfection and very high by historic standards. There was a bull market in complacency, and that was manifested by someone you mentioned, Yardani, earlier in an earlier segment, who was looking for, like Belsky, an excess of 5,000 on the S&P. And 6 months ago, bears were ridiculed as Cassandras. Today, Cassandra's, the Trojan lioness is being lionized. Stocks are no longer priced to perfection. Valuations have retreated from 23 to 16 times. You know the numbers. And many good stocks have been re-rated by 50 or 60% without a real material change in fundamentals. And I think speculation and froth has been rooted out of the markets. Look at Carvana, which has gone from 376 to 25. Coinbase, Robinhood, we have a host of companies like that. The market is literally, Paul, littered with an unprecedented accumulation of disasters. And even the perma bulls have materially lowered their S&P price targets, and Yardani is a very good example. He seems to have thrown in the towel. I think the one point I want to make today is that we don't invest in the present. Recent or coincident events don't move stocks. The rate of future change moves stocks. Good news has permeated the market 6 months ago. Today, bad news surrounds us and is spreading. And equities are a discounting process and mechanism that helps to explain why bear markets are born out of good news and why bull markets are born out of bad news. And when this bad news, like if you recall back to February and March of 2020, the future was murky. And we had a humongous rally off the COVID low. And I think basically to summarize, we're rapidly moving from a period of gross, you can say excessive speculation, elation, complacency on the part of most market participants, and the expectations of only positive outcomes to a period in which speculation has been decimated. Investors have de-risked and degrossed. Stock valuations and economic profit expectations have been reset lower. Fear and the VIX are rising. I don't know if you saw the Bank of America's bull bear indicator yesterday. It's a 0 out of 100. Yep. Zero, not 1 out of 100.
Right, so it's a 0 out of 100.
So the general consensus of expectation now consists of mostly negative outcomes.
Right, so Doug.
And I'm the first one to admit that conditions are far from ideal.
Right.
The negative headwinds have become accepted and to some degree are in the process of being discounted.
All right.
And there are, to me, notable opportunities in selected stocks.
Doug, do I have to be a stock picker here or can I just go out and buy an S&P 500 ETF?
I think the average investor, retail investor, should probably buy the SPY, a passive ETF.
So what are some of the, but you're a professional, you do this for a living. You started at Kidder Peabody way back in 1972.
It's back when the Yankees lost a game.
Exactly, at Kidder Peabody as a housing analyst. What stocks are you looking at?
Well, the first thing to say is that I have doubled my net long position
in
this decline. So that's important to note. I'm still only about 40% net long. Mm-hmm. And to quote Andy Grove, only the paranoid survive. So I come in every day constantly on the lookout, and it leads to an open mind. And I also have learned from Druckenmiller and Soros that sizing is 70 or 80% of the equation.
Yes,
it's really not whether you're right or wrong.
Yes,
it's how much you make when you're right and how much you lose when you're wrong. So the stocks, the sector that I really like to answer your question specifically, Paul, are the banks.
Okay.
We're running out of time. You back on to talk about the banks. Also, the Koufax statue, which is wonderful as well. But what he just said there, folks, on position sizing is gospel. Absolute gospel. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Thank you. Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow. Did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann. Let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.